Hola, hola, hola.
Okay, we start again, please, with the next presentation. The next presentation is from Bas Verschuren. Sorry for the surname pronunciation. Bas Verschuren is a PhD, is a freelance biocultural advisor and researcher. For us, this question of biocultural is still very original work or concept, unfortunately, but that's it. He participated in the UCN and ICOMOS Connecting Practice project, leads the development of UCN best practice guidelines on cultural and spiritual significance of nature in protect and conserve areas. He published 5 books, and I want to and today he will present or he will focus the presentation in the last book. The last book is titled "Cultural and Spiritual Significance of Nature in Protect Areas: Governance, Management, and Policy." Thank you very much, Bas.
Yes, welcome everybody, and thank you, Joseph. So today my presentation is going to be about the cultural and spiritual significance of nature, and about this recent book, which is actually the second last book that I've been publishing. Tell me when I slide off in terms of the altitude of the pitch, because I often don't realize. The book has a history, and I'm going to talk about how it came into being, and also how that history relates to protected areas, conservation practices, and them changing in a sense of the connecting practice project and what we call the nature culture or the culture nature journeys that IUCN and ICOMOS as partners have been holding over time. I'm part of a specialist group under IUCN. The specialist group sits under one of the 6 of the IUCN commissions. The World Commission on Protected Areas is the oldest commission under IUCN. The specialist group deals with cultural and spiritual values of protected areas. We advise the World Commission on Protected Areas on this. And so this book is also part of the member of the work of the members of this specialist group. There are other members here, also one from Catalonia, Josep Maria Malarach, who's himself already done a lot of work on this theme, also specifically for Spain. All right, trying to figure this out. Going for the buttons. Nope. Ah, yes, okay, here we are. So this is the actual cover of the book. It's edited by myself as an IUCN related person, and Steve Brown, who was from Australia at the time, worked at the University of Sydney at the archaeological department, and he's a specialist in cultural heritage, and at the time he was the president of the ICOMOS Scientific Committee on Cultural Landscapes. So we constantly had this interaction about the natural and the cultural ways of dealing with heritage. And this project was also advised on and overseen by Josep Maria Malarach and my co-chair on my specialist group, Edwin Birnbaum. The presentation, as it stands, will deal first with where the book comes from in terms of its inspiration. It will then talk about its origins in nature conservation. We will link this to the nature culture journey and the connecting practice project. And I will give a brief example about the experience that Steve and I had in the Mongolian Altai working on the connecting practice project. And then I will show how this book is part of a broader program that our specialist group on cultural and spiritual values developed to promote the cultural and spiritual significance of nature in conservation practices. And then finally, a little bit more about the book. So, the inspiration, the first part. Can I see a show of hands on who knows who this person is? Of course, we all know this. Come on. No hands. No hands so far. Okay, that's really interesting. This person is Alexander von Humboldt, lived in 1769 up until 1859. And Alexander von Humboldt was a naturalist, and I think he was the first proponent of the Connecting Practice project, to be honest, because he connected natural and social and cultural sciences at the time into one view. He's probably most famous for his theories on ecosystem zoning, like how you see different stages of ecosystems going up mountains around the world. That was Alexander von Humboldt. He's also famous because many boats, streets, places, and regions have been named after him. And because he looked at environmental impacts of human activities. And that's probably one of the first environmental impact assessment instigators in history. You can read about him in this book. Okay, I asked you if you know who he is. You didn't, so you probably haven't read this book. But it's a really great book. It talks about his adventures and about how to him, his look at that time in the Enlightenment period, the birth of science really throughout Europe and spreading across the world, how he developed himself as an interdisciplinary scientist. Then, of course, we have this book that I'm talking about today. But the question is, so what do Alexander von Humboldt, the Connecting Practice Project, and this publication have in common? Well, interestingly, these three people, projects, and books have in common that they talk about the interconnectedness of the cultural and natural world. And as Alexander von Humboldt called this, in his age, like 150 years ago, he said it's an inseparable bond. And we have seen an insoluble bond that was integrated in the text of the convention. I think one of the people who put that wording there was probably already reading Alexander von Humboldt's work. Alexander von Humboldt said, in a world where we tend to draw a sharp line between the sciences and the arts, between the subjective and the objective, Humboldt's insight that we can only truly understand nature by using our imagination makes him a visionary. This connection between knowledge and art and poetry, between science and emotions, the deeply seated bond, as Humboldt called it, is more important than ever before. Humboldt was driven by a sense of wonder for the natural world, a sense of wonder that might help us today to realize that we only protect what we love. And perhaps we need ecosystem services theory for that, or perhaps it is something that is more innate in our own psychology. These interconnectedness. We will explore this a little further, and we will look at how the cultural and spiritual significance of nature has been integrated into nature conservation today. Thank you. So the origins of its origins in nature conservation. And here I'm going back to our little specialist group that gave birth to the book that I'm talking to you about today. This specialist group started in 1993, about. And it really supported the first drafting of the recommendations of the first World Parks Congress. World Parks Congresses are world global fora that are organized every 10 years, draw together protected area managers and people that are active in the management and governance of protected areas. And the recommendations from there, they usually set the course, the global course for protected area management and governance globally. So these recommendations coming out of the 2003 World Parks Congress contained a clause on the cultural and spiritual values of protected areas that were largely drafted by members of our specialist group and members of the IUCN Secretariat. And they were revolutionary in the sense that they supported also the presence of indigenous people being present at that World Parks Forum for the first time in history. They were on the stage. This gave more importance to cultural and spiritual values, but it also accentuated the understanding of that in a way that it was seen as a property that belonged to indigenous peoples. The interesting thing is that our mandate as a specialist group is a bit broader. We look at all cultural and spiritual values that also pertain to the general public or to faith groups, if you will. And to signify that, the chair of our specialist group at the time, together with an academic and protected area professional in the US, so Alan Putney as the chair and David Hammond as the protected area expert and academic, developed this edited volume called The Full Value of Parks. And in 2003, this showed the whole spectra from economics to the intangible. How are these values dealt with in protected areas? Nonetheless, in our specialist group, we turned to a focus on sacred natural sites. And Leticia mentioned this earlier on in her presentation, that these sacred natural sites are often found in World Heritage properties. They're common part and parcel of any landscape, we found out later. But it took us probably a little over a decade of studying the subject to put them on the map in the protected areas community as also being important for biodiversity and giving recognition to the cultural values and the worldviews that related to them. And 2008, this sort of culminated into a best practice guidelines volume. And the title already says it, best practice guidelines for protected area managers on taking sacred natural sites into account in protected areas management, planning, and basically the whole management cycle. We had this focus for a while, and I wanted to show you this because there is a tremendous amount of work went into developing this booklet over 10 years together with UNESCO, and it's the most translated volume in the best practice guidelines series that IUCN has. So if you're interested in best practices on ecosystem services, for example, there is a volume on that. That was launched last month. But if you're interested on a volume on cultural landscapes, there's also a volume on that. And hopefully soon, we will have a volume on cultural and spiritual significance of nature in protected areas as well, which is what I will talk to you about a little bit later on. Anyways, I think we have been relatively successful in creating awareness and recognition for sacred natural sites within the conservation community. There is a lot of work out there, and it meant for our specialist group that we could turn our focus back to its original mission and stick to commitment on process within IUCN. IUCN is a members organization. So the members are the countries, the NGOs, those are dealing with conservation of nature, and they vote on new ideas, new policies on every World Conservation Congress. And these new policies are called motions. When they are accepted, they turn into being resolutions. And our specialist group has been part of developing some of those motions that have been critical in outlining critical thinking and experiences and sentiments that were shared among the members in our specialist group on bringing nature and culture more closely together, usually focusing on specific topics. So in 2003, that had to do with the cultural and spiritual values of protected areas straight out. And then it turned to sacred natural sites, support for custodian protocols and sacred natural sites. In 2012, it was a very important point in time where it was recognition of the diversity of concepts of values of nature, the diversity of concepts and values of nature. And we will come to that a little bit further on. And so it continues until 2016, where we have a particular resolution that recognizes the cultural and spiritual significance of nature in protected areas. So within IUCN, this is the process that can help make a culture, a cultural change, and this culture of change hopefully precipitates also to its members, the member states, but also the NGOs working in IUCN. These motions or these resolutions are also being monitored by assigned people who keep track of whatever is being done with these motions, if they actually create some positive change in the world. And that system is not yet very efficient and could probably improve, but nonetheless, it's there, it's in place now. Okay. Is it also working? We're fine.
Spock to Earth.
Yep. All right, cool. So how do we link all of this in with the nature culture journey? So our specialist group has had this huge body of work that we've been integrating within IUCN. But now in this collaboration with ICOMOS, IUCN is starting to also think about the cultural side of things in a very different way, with different partners, with cultural experts, with people that have focused on cultural evaluations of World Heritage Sites. So the idea there was that we create journeys throughout different events, for example, the World Parks Congress, where these experts demonstrate the work that they've been doing. It's a stream where these different disciplines come together, but also where, for example, the fruits of early collaborations, such as the Protected Practice Project, can be presented. And our specialist group's work was inserted into that stream. So this is a very practical way of how these things at the international level can be demonstrated and work together. And this resulted in 2016 in the Malama Honua commitments that came out of this specific nature and culture journey. And they go as follows. It's to recognize the spiritual and sacred dimension of nature and culture. They've been shortened slightly to fit on the slide and not to make it too lengthy. They talk about value the inspiring examples of harmonious approaches to nature and culture, including place-based approaches, governance and equity, respect for the rights of indigenous peoples and local communities, and strengthening traditional institutions. You can see here there's already themes that were included in those resolutions with IUCN that are resonated in these type of commitments. Recognize our deep concern that cultural and natural diversity and heritage are seriously threatened around the world. Call upon IUCN to develop and adopt a policy understanding and incorporating cultural values and practices in nature conservation. So pressing IUCN to more actively build these bridges and internalize cultural significance in its work. And calling upon ICOMOS to further develop its activities for incorporating natural values and practices in cultural heritage. And that last point had added to it, such as organizing a culture nature journey at the General Assembly of ICOMOS, which happened in 2017, and the result was the Yatra Aur Tamana. This is an Indian world of walking the same road together. So no longer Jean-Claude Van Damme stretched in between two trucks driving on the highway, but an ancient Hindu understanding going 3,000 years back, which already had that, is here resurrected to make a point about how nature and culture could be integrated. And it starts out with pointing out that Western languages that reflect a Western ontology, the way of knowing the world, that separates nature from people, and this permeates our culture, thinking, and approaches. ICOMOS and IUCN and all their partners should therefore aim to find different concepts and different worlds that can overcome this situation. And this was remarked earlier as put forward to Leticia as a question, like, how come we're not simply doing this? But okay,
we're being challenged to do this. And for these reasons, we use nature cultures with no space, no hyphen in between them, because we recognize that these domains are inseparable, entangled, and mutually constituted. So here's, for example, the presentation of new concepts that are being introduced in the global arena. And yes, it's a complete, you know, there's a lot of work that can still be put into what nature cultures really are. Is it the same as biocultural diversity? Well, maybe it incorporates biocultural diversity, but it's maybe more flexible. How can we develop this? How can we make this concept more useful in our connecting practice project or in our nature culture journey? So this is one challenge. I mean, interesting topic for master's thesis, for example. So how to further integrate the cultural and spiritual significance of nature along the road of its conservation relevance? So let's take a slightly closer look at those nature cultures within the connecting practice project. Because I realized, having been part of this connecting practice project in the first phase, this is where I met Steve Brown in the Mongolian Altai. I realized that reflecting back on nature cultures and my experience there, I came to a couple of conclusions that were very interesting, and I want to share them with you. So in the connecting practice project, I went to the Altai. The mission there, defining new methods and strategies to support nature and culture through engagement in the World Heritage Convention, broadly. We noticed that these nature and culture are so much integrated, and this experience is part of our book. It's a chapter in the book that talks about this, and in the book we have a personal statement by each author, and ours starts like, "Watch out," Steve called to Bas. "What, you're about to stand on a rock engraving." "Watch out," Bas repeated. "You're standing on an endangered juniper bush." And in reality, it was really hard not to step on anything of cultural or natural values in that area. It was incredibly rich. But we also realized then that we were drawn back to our own disciplinary roots. Steve as a geologist and a sociologist, and me as an environmental scientist and, well, later a PhD in anthropology. So sort of coming full circle, but we were drawn back to our earliest teachings and we contested them. And from this contestation came a discussion on how to better integrate this, and the nature cultures were born. But in the nomination files for the sites, they were developed with a focus on art history at the time. This is years ago, and the person did a brilliant job at describing the relevance of these petroglyphs that are scattered around the Altai landscape from an art history perspective. But you can imagine that this specific scientific disciplinary outlook also denies other perspectives of interconnectedness on the landscape. For example, if the Altai would have been nominated for outstanding natural values, which in the case of the Mongolian Altai may be very difficult, but there's snow leopards, there's all sorts of red-listed species there that could potentially support that. You know, it's easy to imagine that that could also happen, this landscape in itself, without man in it. When you look at it like this, it's amazing. But then you see that this landscape is actually a landscape that's created by nomads that has grazing in it. And here's the dilemma that Leticia mentioned earlier. This grazing is a beautiful sign of a nomadic culture, a pastoralist culture. And at the same time, it's also a pressure on the rock engravings. Should we put a fence around those rock engravings? And then how many kilometers of fence do we need? How much area do we have left for grazing? So these are the practicalities that people in this area, especially the managers, have to deal with. Well, in our view, it was like a battle of experts. We had our expert vehicle driver, the protected area expert, actually Mr. Altai, who was the director of the protected areas, three protected areas combined into different properties. There was, of course, the nomad who knew the area culturally through his own worldview. And there are, of course, the other than human experts, the parts of nature that don't have a voice in our debates. And I go here as an ICN person, and of course we have the horse. So this was an interesting instigation for more discussion. And we found here that there's sacred mountains there, and that spirits control the use of those mountains and the surroundings of those mountains. And that relates to a different tradition of shamanism. Actually, the early roots of world shamanism are found in the Siberian areas and in the Altai. So we are dealing with very old religious traditions. There's also stupas there of more recent Buddhist activity, and there are statues of Turkish invaders that testify of different religious and cultural uses. But they're also nowadays the places where people build their homesteads, build their winter camps, and where the landscape is actively being used and maintained, but also places where the petroglyphs, as they have been recognized in the nomination file as an art form, are not necessarily an art form, but a cultural practice of engraving rather than making art. You can see here on the photo that there is even recent rock engravings that people continue a tradition into today. And there is something to say about looking at an understanding of what values and what practices do we want to maintain from a cultural perspective. Does this need to be authentic, as the World Heritage Convention, for example, prescribes? And what does that authenticity then mean? And how do we deal with this at the level of site management? So all these questions came into being, and we realized that, yeah, there actually is this relationship between some of those World Heritage criteria. And where Leticia was pointing out the 6 cultural and the 4 natural, we figured there's bridging criteria there. Maybe what if we reinterpret these criteria with a little bit more flexibility, or with a bit more knowledge that we have about how nature and culture can be interconnected, can we play with them more without going back to having to revising these principles? But honestly, it's actually a way of looking back to the moment where some of the detail of some of these criteria were removed when they were revised the last time in 97, right? Was it 2005. So 2005. And interestingly enough, like looking back to go forward, there's cultures that have like symbolized and encrypted meanings for this. This is a Sankofa from Ghana, which exactly means that you have to look backwards to your heritage to be able to move forward. And I think this is also what needs to happen in the World Heritage Convention, is reflecting on its development and how to better move forward. And connecting practices can really help in bringing out some of those ideas that we could reflect on more and develop for the future. What do we do with all this knowledge about cultural and spiritual protected areas, our own development within our specialist group, the book that we have there, the nature culture journey in which it all fits together and becomes more exposed to a broader set of disciplinary streams of schools of thinking? We figured in our specialist group that we might set up a program that enables us to think about the cultural and spiritual significance of nature as a concept that is a little broader than has been previously been defined. So we define these things, the cultural and spiritual significance of nature, for the purpose of being broadly applicable as the cultural and spiritual, aesthetic, historic, and social meanings, knowledge, values, and feelings, ideas, and associations to the natural features and nature in general that reveal and inspire in people, both individuals and groups. So this is a very broad definition that doesn't in or exclude specific groups. It also makes it very relevant because it talks about relationships between people and their environment. And it also makes it relevant because it's not just talking about values that you can isolate and then categorize and deal with. It also talks about including ways of knowing your environment. And this, as we will see later, is very important. So, of course, we had to think of why this is important to protected areas, because our specialist group informs the World Commission on Protected Areas. And they asked us to draw up this slide and show them why is that innovative and effective. Well, you know, it helps build a sustainable and effective conservation solution, because solutions that are built with cultural and spiritual significance of nature in mind are deemed to be more socially credible and more inclusive of people's rights and relationships with nature. But then, okay, you can say that, but how do you show implementation and impact? So it improves understanding and willingness for all stakeholders to care for and support protected areas and conservation. So this, drawing back to our first quote of Humboldt, is saying that we protect only what we love, is a key motivation for protection. And if everybody is allowed to say what, why, and how they love nature, then this becomes an inclusive process of a way forward in bringing nature and culture, or cultural and spiritual significance of nature, into protected area management, planning, and governance. So this improved integration is something that we are really aiming for. We are doing this in five different ways within this program. It's called the Cultural and Spiritual Significance of Nature Program, as you might have guessed. The book is one of the products that emerged from this. There's also an international ICN best practice guideline that we are developing, as I mentioned earlier. And it's part of this program. So really the book that I'm talking to you about complements these guidelines that that are actually meant for protected area managers, or those people that are working in the management and governance of protected area. It contains a set of principles, and it contains sets of guidelines that actually help people that are working on the ground or in the planning process or in the governance process to really think systematically through how cultural and spiritual significance can be integrated in their work, that in their reality of work. And it uses examples from around the world to illustrate how other people have done that. In addition to that, we want to develop training modules that are based on people's experiences with these guidelines. And we want to develop these training modules using pilots in World Heritage Sites and protected areas around the world. So it doesn't necessarily need to be a World Heritage Site, but where there is a space for implementing these guidelines, we would like to collaborate to build training modules that then can be used by people in similar situations. And to support that, we have a range of case studies that are online on our website, on csvpa.org. And they're also part of these guidelines, and some of them are part of the book. So this is really sort of an integrated approach to show different ways of interacting with a target audience. Interestingly, the book itself, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, goes a little bit more into depth. You can imagine that into international guidelines for a specific target audience, you cannot talk about Buddhist philosophy and its implications for nature conservation, but in our book we can. So our book actually, after a long trajectory of our specialist group, sort of is the predecessor to this earlier book, The Full Value of Parks. It's taken on the same theme, but with almost 15 years of experience in between, starts talking about the new concepts, starts linking with new ideas, and also starts digging back into the philosophical and conceptual areas. So it's been developed and published by our specialist group. It's been developed by our specialist group, published by Routledge, the Taylor and Francis group. And it's inspired by the Nature Culture Journey, but it contains about 20 chapters from 48 authors. And as editors, we coordinate these contributions. And one thing that you can do as an editor is to create chapters that have a certain, address the key themes in a similar sort of voice. What we also did was making sure that each chapter goes with a motivation from the authors about why are they writing this chapter? How, what was the basis for their experience? A little bit like I read out about the incident that Steve and I had in the Altai. That way chapter, all of the chapters start, which makes it very personable, and you're basically sort of drawn in wanting to read the chapter more, and you can understand where these words, these teachings, this learning comes from. So there's three sections in the book. Talks about concepts, about the philosophical underpinnings of the cultural and spiritual significance of nature. It talks about policy and practice, so looking at exciting new cross-cutting conservation programs like Connecting Practice. And yes, there's a chapter from Leticia and her colleagues in the book that complement that. And there's a bunch of case studies. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what sort of concepts the book addresses. And although this isn't a sales pitch, I really do hope that, you know, you will be able to get the book, if not personally, then through the library of the university in the future. Because it talks about different concepts and values of nature. A chapter that was lead authored by Josep Maria Malarach and six other members of our specialist group. And it actually took this, our considerations of this earlier resolution that we got passed in IUCN, is that the world, the concepts that we use to define nature are different around the world. That these different worldviews that we have around the world actually result into different ideas of what nature really is, and result into the identification of different value sets that we apply when we deal with our environment. And this multiplicity had previously not been addressed in IUCN, and this chapter talks about why this is really important. And a small example is, of course, that in many of the world's languages, there is no word for nature, no direct word for nature, or for conservation, for that matter. And there are cultural concepts and ways of knowing the world that express something that maybe comes close to this Western wording and the Western concepts behind it that have shaped protected areas and World Heritage Convention. But there is truly a huge diversity there. And if you look at the mural here, you see a Buddhist depiction of the universe, with the center of the world being Mount Meru, one of the most sacred mountains in the Himalaya, with different spheres of interaction around it that constitute Buddhist practice and Buddhist worldview. So this is not always expressed just in words, as we are used to learn intellectually at universities. There's also art traditions that explain the ways of knowing the world. Other aspects that we pick out when we talked about the concepts in the book are nature connectedness and meaningful nature experience. And this is a chapter developed by a good friend of mine named Matthew Zelstra, who also has a website called Eyes for Earth. It's really worth looking up, eyesforearth.com. And Matt's been researching connectedness to nature and special experiences that people have in nature. For a little over 10 years now, I think. And he explains in this chapter how this deeply seated bond that Alexander von Humboldt talked about, how this actually comes into being. He goes a little bit into the psychology of creating this bond that motivates us to protect what we love, really. And then another chapter I wanted to highlight, there's several more under concepts, is a chapter that's written by Crystal Buckley, who at the time for ICOMOS was the person who co-created the Connecting Practice project. And she started thinking about this concept of authenticity, what is truly authentically cultural, and started reflecting, because of the Connecting Practice project, what does authenticity mean in nature conservation? Do we have authentic nature? You know, we probably all know discussions about what constitutes wilderness and what makes this this understanding of nature that we have today as a wild areas that are truly authentic. Perhaps that's the word. But she starts exploring these concepts in both arenas, And she starts drawing out why they match and why they don't. Very interesting stuff. The next section on the book deals with policy and practice, and basically it talks about nature culture journeys and IUCN ICMOS. It talks about World Heritage Connecting Practice projects, but also has a chapter on the Ramsar Convention, which has a network, the Ramsar Culture Network, that look at the cultural values, cultural significance of wetlands. And this group has been developing within the Ramsar Convention, so also a large multilateral agreement, one of the environmental conventions, in fact, which is comparable to the World Heritage Convention. It's the country signatories that adhere to this policy. And this little group in Ramsar has been trying to improve the integration of cultural values under the Ramsar Convention through affecting its policies in various different ways. And it describes its journey on how they do that and what progress has been made to date. Eventually, there is a series of case studies, and I wanted to highlight the following ones. The Feng Shui Forest in China. Like many places in China used to have village forests that were placed around the villages according to the principles of Feng Shui, which is ancient Chinese philosophy and suits the energetic layout of the landscape. And the village would not be complete without having its energy organized, and therefore you need Feng Shui forest. These Feng Shui forests in many cases still exist, and the researchers here look at the different values of these forests, the biodiversity values, but also their cultural values and their political meaning today. And it's one of the, it reports on one of the largest inventories of Feng Shui forests in China that has been done to date. So it's kind of exciting in that way. Yeah? Another chapter talks about Batwa culture, Batwa people that had originally been expelled from some of the protected areas that had been designated for gorilla conservation, and are now reconnecting back with cultural places in their protected areas. And you know, the efforts that have been undertaken by people to work with the protected area staff and the agencies involved to make this happen. Also, there is talk about human and non-human agency in conservation in Vanuatu, and this is very interesting because we think that conservation is the task of people. The Western concept of conservation deals with management actions of people, but in many different cultures around the world, conservation is the task of spirits. This may sound a little bit weird, but it's true. Belief in spirits regulates human behavior in many parts of the world. In the Himalaya is a case in point, where in Bond shamanism, each mountain has resident spirits that need to be appeased, that have rituals attached to it, that rituals need to be carried out, and that depends, also dictates where you can go, where you cannot go, which time of the year, and therefore certain pieces of the mountain are better conserved than others. Linking back to this example that Leticia showed on Kanchenjunga in India earlier, that's a good case in point. Yes, these beliefs are crumbling. In some places they are being revived. In some cases they are actually used as a political argument. But that's okay. That's very interesting for an anthropologist or sociologist. There's also a case study that looks at religious landscapes in Italy, landscapes of production, of food production, looking at how spaghetti is created and how that's linked to the landscape, but also looking at how different rituals that take place in villages are actually linked to the surrounds of the village, and I'm sure that they exist here in Catalonia as well. But it just draws closer parallels between these cultural practices and their religious importance and their integration into management and conservation. And that's why this chapter is particularly interesting. And finally, we end with a case study on place attachment in Australia, which as a colonizing nation is relatively young. So we see different layers of place attachment. We have an ancient culture that has over 50,000 years on the continent with huge place attachment in place. And we see a colonial culture on top of that relatively young place attachment. And how do you manage these things? So this chapter talks more about also the importance of the colonial heritage, but in the context of this larger history. Very respectfully and very interesting. Puts the challenges of a practical case in New South Wales forward and reflects on the different governance regimes and policies that exist in Australia today. So with this, I'd actually wanted to end the presentation, probably point out that the book is complementary to these guidelines that we are developing at the moment that will be out probably next year. I have a few leaflets and a discount code should you be interested in ordering the book, or should the library be interested in doing that. And I think with that, yeah, we'll close it here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bas. Do you have any question for Bas?
Hi. I'm wondering, so you pointed out the significance of spiritual and cultural values for nature protection, but how relevant are these in a contemporary world where we see that certain cultures are dominated and young generations are starting to lose certain values? And, well, I'll give a specific case, which is perhaps an extreme case, so that's not perhaps...
Talk a little bit closer to the microphone.
Right. So I went to Ghana, and there's a lake called Lake Busumche, and it's a sacred lake for the Ashanti people. So they believe that the lake is a god, it represents a god. So when I went to understand a little bit better the situation, I met first of all a group of kids, and they were angry because there was some pollution besides the lake, but they were angry from more not because they would anger the gods, but more from an environmental perspective, because it's not good to pollute nature. And then I went a little bit further, and I saw there's enormous deforestation. There's an enormous population boom, and this results in overfishing. Chemicals are running into the lake, and you also see how Christianity is teaching the people not anymore to practice certain spiritual practices. They understand that something is wrong because there's the fish that they now are able to get is very small, but they say that the god is angry because the Ashanti king has not blessed the lake yet, and the Ashanti king has not blessed the lake yet because he is Christian. He doesn't believe in these practices anymore. So I wonder how relevant certain practices are in today's world, from your experience.
Yes, thank you. Your name is Sil, right? Yeah, thank you, Sil. I think, in part, you've already given the answer to your own question, because you can see that there's different attitudes, different beliefs, and different perspectives, which is the reality with almost every site in the world. We have to manage these different views and values that people hold, and these values are changing. Like in the Venice Charter, I think it also says that culture is not static, it's dynamic, and the cultural values associated with it, they also change. So when I say that a belief of spirits regulates people's behavior, yes it does, but it doesn't mean that it will always keep doing that. If at a local level it's decided that it is important that this belief remains intact, then there has to be a certain local support for that. And people will have to think of a way to convince the king to bless the lake, perhaps, or to find to talk to their god and appoint somebody new to do it. Whatever creative cultural solution comes out of that process, I don't know. But I imagine that with the current levels of globalization, spreading of technology, the opening up of areas in terms of education, state education, road development, companies coming in and impacting on sites, we will see a lot more of those changes. Yeah. Then, briefly, I worked in northern Ghana, around Wa, in the Lora area, and there's a lot of sacred groves that are currently being threatened by an Australian mining company. What can you do to stop a mining company for cutting down community sacred groves once the government has already given out a mining license to the company? How do you negotiate as a community with that mining company, and how do you address your government in terms of showing that there is an issue there? These political circumstances are very difficult, especially for people that are perceived to be disempowered in these circumstances. And that's where a lot of work can still be done, I think. Working with local people directly and finding solutions, creating, working together, creating a common ground, and finding a way forward. What that is, what it looks like, will be different in every situation, I do think.
To ask you about one specification, if you could, about the Italian sacred sites. I'm interested to know what kind of sacred sites are involved in your program.
Okay, this in the chapter in the book discusses not so much the sacred places, but the festivals, the religious festivals that are in a way linked to places, whether you recognize these as religiously important or sacred, is a bit more irrelevant. But I would actually have to look up the name of the places.
We have to buy your book because I saw that we have it in our libraries.
Ah, okay, well. Even at the university that I work at, it is not there. And so, yeah, the same task. Yeah, but maybe I can look that up afterwards and we can talk about it a little bit more. Right?
I don't know if you introduced in the book the question of the climate change and environmental change. So because the cultural and spiritual significance of nature is very related to the physical and the natural conditions of the place. If these natural conditions are changing, how we, I don't know. This is
how does
know,
culture change?
Yeah. How you manage this question in the book, if you introduce this question of the global change, climate change? And
well, you need many more books to address that question, and you will never be accurate. But we are mindful that there is this; these changes are happening quickly, globally. And what we are saying is, if culture also changes, and with several of the problems that Syl mentioned popping up in almost every area, has its particular problems because of climate change, globalization, infrastructural development. And the case studies in this book deal with how you can respectfully integrate cultural and spiritual significance of nature in your protected area by dealing with it at these localities. So there are really examples of how that it has been done already in different places, and is different in each case. So for example, I think in Vanuatu, the conservation planning there is not so much pertained to the protected areas, but it's a lesson for protected area management that many local people already are conserving nature through their own culture. And in most of the islands, it's relatively intact, and they have their own ways of working with nature, which result into a high biodiversity and healthy ecosystems, mostly. There's some climate change impact. I don't know how they would address that, personally. But you see that taking up this local understanding, the local beliefs, the local practices, and it making them part of conservation planning was far more useful than coming out with a concept of protected area planning that was developed based on the Yellowstone model, for example. So it talks about these lessons. And other examples, but I really encourage you to perhaps also go on our website or csvva.org and look at the case studies that are there. They all have, like at the end of them, they're about 1,000 words each, at the end of them they have a little list with lessons learned. And you will find some solutions that people have found locally in these listings. So they're very easy to actually browse. I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
Hi, I'm from India, from an indigenous community, and most of the times the struggles we have had is with the government. So I'm just wondering, in your research, for example, we come from a belt which is very rich in minerals. So the lands that we have been protecting have been taken away for mining, uranium, for example, iron ore, and there's a lot of industrialization.
Yeah.
So it has really affected how the indigenous people in this area used to live. So I was just wondering your opinion on this, and I mean, what you have maybe seen in your research so far.
All right. That's a very broad question. Oh, where are you from, if I may ask? Where in India are you from?
Jharkhand.
Jharkhand, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking so. Yeah, and it's super. The mining is going wild there. Yeah. I said wild, not well, but I imagine that the mining companies are doing very well. Yeah. That's interesting. What can you do against multinational or national state companies that are operating regardless of indigenous people's rights, right? Like the UN, the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous People is a non-legally binding bilateral agreement, but it's used by local and indigenous people within the nature conservation movement to present themselves more strongly in terms of defending their right also within the conservation movement. So I can sort of draw your question into what's happening in the nature conservation movement. There is a network there called the ICCA Consortium. You can look them up on the internet. It's a broad movement. I don't know how many member organizations, indigenous and local communities that they have. And they organize themselves at meetings of the CBD, of the World Heritage Convention, of all these environmental conventions, and they try to influence what is happening there in favor of recognizing the rights of indigenous people and local communities. And because the conservation movement has opened up, some say slowly, others say more and more, we see that there's also more recognition of local communities and what they do in terms of conserving nature. And I think that many indigenous people around the world are looking for partners that can strengthen their case in claiming their rights and not having their territory mined over, but rather have it recognized as their own indigenous territory, for which they probably have rights. And if they don't, then that's a very often very difficult political situation. What you do in each specific case, like I can give a practical example of my work in Ghana. I work with a local community to create what they call a community protocol. So the community sat and thought about what are our traditions, what are our values. They've written this down. And then they said, what do we have in our community in terms of riches? What is important to us? Our sacred groves, our sacred ponds, our rivers, the lands where we cultivate. And these are our resources. And now we are going to look at the international level policies that that steer our national level policies, and we are going to look at how we can claim control over what we have. And we can use this document, which we call a community protocol, as a way to negotiate with a mining company, or with the government, or both of them. And it helps creating an area of practice between these actors where they can learn about each other and hopefully get engaged and find ways of working forward. But that's a practical thing that can be done.